such thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Merrill Ain, author of the new novel, Shadows We Carry. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This coming week, we'll celebrate the Festival of Shavuot, the holiday that recalls the great events of the Revelation at Mount Sinai, our people of Israel receiving the Ten Commandments. Shavuot literally means weeks. The holiday celebrating the conclusion of the 7 weeks of counting between Passover, the Festival of Freedom, and Shavuot or Shavuos, celebrating the Great Covenant enacted at Mount Sinai. It was on Shavuot that, according to Jewish tradition, the greatest human interaction with God in all history took place. At this time of year, about 3,200 years ago, we received the Ten Commandments in dramatic fashion, according to the book of Exodus, with lightning and thunder, smoke, fire, and an earthquake, and the blasts of the shofar ringing in the desert air. And out of all that tumult, God's voice clearly conveyed the great message of morality and ethics that includes the Ten Commandments. Without the holiday of Shavuot, which begins Thursday night this week, we wouldn't have the Torah. And without the Torah, well, we wouldn't have Judaism. The key question for Jews, and one of the things that shapes whether you are a Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox Jew, is just exactly what you think took place that fateful day so long ago. For Orthodox Jews, it was God directly giving the people of Israel the Ten Commandments, and the rest of the Torah, and the rest of the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, and even in theory, the whole oral Torah, the Talmud, the Mishnah, the Gemara. For conservative Jews, Sinai was the revelation of at least the Ten Commandments that God spoke to us directly. For most Reformed Jews, it was God's presence and connection that was conveyed, or perhaps just the Ten Commandments in some inspirational way. And for atheists, the whole thing was a collective, simultaneous imagination of about 2 million people. So, why does all this matter? Simply put, it's because the source of authority for all the mitzvot, all the commandments, rests on where they came from. If they are given by God or inspired by divine experience, well, that gives them a powerful voice in our lives. If they are simply derived from human experience, that is, they are laws created by people, they are no more authoritative than any other human legislation, say the laws passed by the U.S. Congress or a local council or board or, dare I say it, homeowners association. In other words, without according some belief that God gave us the initial moral charge in the Ten Commandments, following an ethical way of life is no more significant than obeying traffic laws or the tax code. I guess I vote for the belief that something amazing did happen at Mount Sinai, something so powerful, wonderful, and potent, it has remained in content and memory at the heart of all Western religion ever since. That is, whether God gave us these specific words, or simply inspired us to rise to a higher level of justice, goodness, and holiness in our lives, the revelation at Sinai compelled our people and many peoples ever since to seek to create lives of meaning and sanctity. The amazing events at Sinai may have happened long ago, but we will celebrate that experience afresh this week on the late spring, early summer festival of Shavuot, this Thursday night, Friday, and Saturday. So to play us in this morning, in the spirit of the Torah on Too Jewish. Here's a classic setting of Louis Lewandowski's composition, Uvenucha Yomar Ki Lekach Tov, Eitz Chaim Hi Lamachazikim Ba. The Torah is a tree of life to all who hold fast to it. As sung by master cantor Naftali Hershtick, I studied with him long ago, and the choir of the Great Synagogue of Jerusalem. That was Lewandowski's Uvenucha Yomar. The Torah is a tree of life, and the Ten Commandments are at its very heart. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Merrill Ain, explores the lives of second-generation survivors and the children of other World War II figures as they journey through their young adult lives in the 60s, 70s, and on. It's a great read. Meet her and hear about her new book when she joins us in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pascuayaki tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Merrill Ain is an author, podcaster, educator. Her first book, The Takeaway Men, or her first fictional book, I should say, was a post-Holocaust debut novel published a few years ago and won awards. Her new book is called Shadows We Carry, a novel. And it, well, I don't want to give it all away, but it continues the story. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Well, good morning, Rabbi, and thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So here's a little bit of an off-the-wall question. You've done a lot of things. What made you decide to write the great American Jewish novels?
Well, yes, I either you can say that I continued to reinvent myself or my attention span is not that
well. ADD, I don't know.
I don't think I am. But anyway, so I had a variety of careers. And then I started out as a high school history teacher. Oh. And I retired as a school district administrator. And once I retired, it was kind of, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? But I had always written. I did a stint in journalism. I've written a cooking column. I've written features. I've done interviews. So I and a lot of essays. In fact, I have an essay that was published for Mother's Day in JNS. So I've always writing. In fact, my brother says that writing in our family is a competitive sport because we have so many writers. My husband is a journalist. My daughter-in-law is an author. My husband, you know, my brother writes. Anyway, so writing is in my blood. So once I retired, I joined a book club. And prior to that, I really had not read much in the way of fiction. Maybe I read two novels a year. I used to read, when I had time, nonfiction for enjoyment. History, biographies,
sure.
Autobiographies.
Well, you're a history teacher originally.
Right, you know? Right.
Yeah. If you love history, and I love history, it's an addiction.
So now I joined a book club, and we were reading a novel a month. And I found that I really loved novels. And the more I read, the more I challenged myself, am I able to write a novel? And I kept, and then I read some on my own in between, and I kept reading it and trying to unlock the secret of what it was to write a novel, and I couldn't. And I came to the conclusion that I don't know how to do this. But then I got some books and read some articles and took some classes, and I decided that I could do it. And the reason, I guess, that was a long way of answering your question, which was, you know, I wanted to tell this particular story through the vehicle of a novel, and that is what both books are about: Holocaust survivors and their children and their peers, and what happened to these families after the war, because, you know, we have a lot written about the Holocaust per se, but what actually happened to them afterwards. And I thought that the best way of telling this story would be in a novel.
It's a dramatic, interesting, I think fascinating novel. And we will talk much more with Meryl Ain about Shadows We Carry and writing in general when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Sign up for religious school for next year for school-aged children or grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with excellent Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night, 6:30 p.m. for services, or Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m., services at 10 a.m. Or come on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our musical services with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them are in person and by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and available on Zoom. Access them through our website,
BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format, too. Some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. And don't forget Shavuot. This coming Friday night and Saturday, we'll have Yisker services Saturday morning. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, 2JewishRadio.com, T-O-O JewishRadio.com. Streaming us from the website or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and now on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review 2 Jewish wherever you listen to us. All those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And again, welcome back from the Balkans and Vienna. You talked about Vienna a little bit last time. Some more stories.
I will focus more on Vienna today because it's a city where I lived for 5 years. It's like a second home to me. I have a lot of friends there. And this time, because I planned my trip long in advance, various friends, married couples mostly, were nice enough to come in from other parts of Europe to spend time with me, a lunch or a dinner or an afternoon walking tour through the historic cafes of Vienna, whatever. There was a couple from Malta. There were two married couples from Belgrade. There was a guy from Sarajevo with whom I worked in Vienna years ago who drove up in part to see his parents to celebrate the end of Ramadan, and in part to spend an evening with me. And so I like juggled all kinds of people who don't really know each other and don't necessarily have any common languages, but it was a lot of fun. And a couple things were really striking to me. One is there is a proliferation and it's increasing. I mean, it's like incrementally, or what's the mathematical term when something goes up?
Geometric.
Whatever.
Exponentially.
Exponentially. Thank you very much.
That's all the math I know. I'm done.
Okay. But it's the number of kosher restaurants and other points of Jewish interest, museums, monuments, memorials, but specifically restaurants. I mean, in the old days, there was one that was open for Shabbat and you had to buy stuff in advance and that was it. Now there's like five or six at least, and a lot of Israeli tour groups. Now, obviously, not all Israelis are kosher, but the ones who go to Vienna either want kosher food and they go to the kosher restaurants, or they want Israeli food and they go to Israeli restaurants, which are not necessarily kosher, but which exist and serve Israeli salad and hummus and falafel and things that Israelis tend to miss when they travel. So that's a big difference. There are a couple things that are more subtle differences that I think only somebody who's lived there for a long time would know. My earliest visits to Vienna back in the 70s and 80s, most of the people who worked as like housekeepers in hotels and servers in restaurants and barkeepers and stuff like that were Turks. Now they're almost all from the former Yugoslavia, and their common language is Serbian. And there are whole neighborhoods where all you hear is Serbian. Even if they're from some other part of the former Yugoslavia, the language that kind of unites them is Serbian. And you hear that all the time. And the Austrians, in spite of their reputation for racism, anti-Semitism, whatever, have done a very good job of A, combating anti-Semitism and like re-legitimizing the large Jewish presence in Vienna, and of welcoming all these disparate immigrants, even if they sometimes refer to them derogatorily as people from down there. Down there being geographically, because
farther down in the Balkans,
or southeast of Vienna.
Right.
But not very far. I mean, there's almost no city in the former Yugoslavia that's more than an hour away by air.
Huh.
So it's close. But the thing that I noticed the most, and is a real contrast to how America has evolved, is even in these days of spiraling violence and racism and homophobia and all that, the Viennese are still incredibly polite. And you'll always hear like please and thank you and after you. And, you know, they're very welcoming. They're very gracious. And they're not, they never yell at you for any reason. Whereas the other day I had a fender bender in a parking lot and a woman got out of her car. She was actually at fault for trying to drive past me at a ridiculous speed as I was slowly backing out of a place. And when I saw her in my rearview mirror, I stopped. So I barely tapped her and she got a little dent. She came out of the car, arms flailing, said, "What the hell is wrong with you?" Cursing, screaming, like, "I could shoot you." And probably if she had a gun, she
would have. Yeah.
And, you know, America has become a scary place. People like are on a very short fuse. And it was a marked contrast to the degree of civilization and manners and old-fashioned, almost quaintness that I found everywhere I traveled, including Montenegro, which is rumored to be full of bandits and highwaymen and brigands.
Right.
But there, people were way more polite. And you particularly see this when you go to restaurants, in the quality of the service, in the quality of human interactions. It's a really striking cultural difference that I did not feel 10 or 20 years ago.
Fascinating. Tom, thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Abe is on his deathbed at the age of 98. He weakly raises his head and through whispered breaths he asks, "Where is my wife, my Chana?" "Oy, I'm here, my love," says the older woman as she clutches her husband's hand. "It's good. And where's my son Moshe?" says Abe. "Is he here?" "I'm here too, Dad," says Moshe. "My darling daughter Sara, where is she?" asks Abe. "Papa, I love you," says Sara. "My grandchildren, Danny, Ruthie, Rivka, Eli, Yoni." "We are all here, Zadie," the grandchildren say. "So, all my family is here in the room with me now?" says Abe. "Of course, dear," answers his wife. And Abe says, "So why is the light on in the kitchen?" An alternate version of that joke goes, "So, who's minding this store?" That was the old Jewish joke, the week special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This Friday and Saturday at the holiday of Shavuot, we will chant the Ten Commandments, the most famous statements on morality found in the world, or at least in Western religion. They were given by the hand of Moses on Mount Sinai, we're told. Sinai is also called Mount Horeb, according to tradition. Yeah. The Hebrew name for the Ten Commandments is Aseret HaDibrot, almost generically titling them the Ten Statements, as though they were like all other divine sayings. The distinction we make is interesting. Mitzvot, commandments, are direct orders with specific implications. Dibrot, divine statements, are both broader categories of instructions and sometimes more enlightening. There are also arguably far more than 10 commandments encapsulated in these statements, and it's true that some of them are not commandments at all. The 10 begin with, I am the Lord your God, a powerful statement of God's existence, but not a specific command to believe. There are both a few positive commandments, honor your father and your mother, honor the Sabbath day and keep it holy, observe the Shabbat, and a larger series of negative commands. Don't have other gods. Don't take God's name in vain. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't bear false witness. Don't covet what isn't yours. It's a powerful series of statements about what makes for an ethical life. But it is also understood in Judaism to be far from complete. We have not 10 commandments in Judaism, but Taryag Mitzvot, 613. Mitzvot, ethical commandments, form the structure of a life of goodness. Recounting the centrality of these 10 is a reminder that there is much more to being a moral person and a good Jew than even these great sentences can convey. May we each be inspired to seek the influence of many commandments of meaning and purpose to make our lives good and sacred. When we come back in a moment, our guest this morning, Meryl Ain, explains how she moved from her first post-Holocaust novel to a more contemporary exploration of identity and journey, all that in her new book. Find out more when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Codex Sassoon, the only 1,100-year-old copy of the Hebrew Bible in existence, became the most expensive book ever sold last week when it drew a price of $38.1 million at an auction at Sotheby's in New York City. The buyer of the Codex Sassoon was the American fundraising group that works on behalf of the Museum of the Jewish People in Tel Aviv, the museum formerly known as Beit HaTfutzot. The museum, said attorney Alfred Moses, a former U.S. ambassador to Romania, and his family provided the funds for the purchase. The manuscript is the world's oldest, nearly complete copy of the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh. It was handwritten in Syria, or perhaps Israel, roughly 1,100 years ago, on 792 pages of sheepskin. The Codex Sassoon includes all 24 books of the Bible. It misses only about 8 pages. Its writing and layout are like a Torah scroll. The seller, Swiss financier and collector Jacques Safra, had owned the volume since 1989. The speculation about where the book would end up led to anxiety it might be sold to a private collector, not a public institution that would put it on display. Those doubts were put to rest when the museum, formerly called the Museum of the Jewish Diaspora, said the book will be part of its core exhibition. The Hebrew Bible is the most influential book in history, constitutes the bedrock of Western civilization. I rejoice knowing it belongs to the Jewish people, said Moses. It was my mission. That's not the Moses, but the lawyer Moses who donated the money. Anyway, it was my mission, realizing the historic significance of Codex Sassoon, to see that it resides in a place with global access to all people. You know, just saying, it's wonderful that a guy named Moses gave the Codex Sassoon to Beit HaTfutzot. Anyway, just a handful of buyers competed for the book, in person at Sotheby's or by phone, and the auction took less than 6 minutes.
Ahead of the auction, Sotheby's estimated the item would sell for anywhere from $30 million to $50 million. The gavel price was $33.5 million, but with fees and premiums, the final price tag was $38.1 million. Since no book or historical document quite like it has ever been sold at auction, or at least not for decades, the Codex Sassoon has earned comparisons to other foundational texts of civilization that have also commanded tens of millions of dollars. A copy of the first printing of the U.S. Constitution's final text sold for $43.2 million in 2021. The Codex Lester, a journal with writings by Leonardo da Vinci, fetched $30.8 million in 1994, and a copy of the Magna Carta sold for $21.1 million in 2007. This is one of the rarest, unique, uniting documents that ever existed, Irina Nevzlin, the chair of the museum's board of directors, said. For us to have it in the museum where it will be available for all those millions of people, this is something that can strengthen our roots and our identity, because it's something eternal. She added, we are the right home for it for so many reasons, and we are based here in Israel. Citing a major crisis in Jewish education, Israel's diaspora ministry plans to invest $40 million training educators at Jewish schools in the U.S. and Canada. Amichai Chikli, Israel's Minister of Diaspora Affairs, announced the initiative called Alephbet, after, of course, the first two letters of the Hebrew alphabet. The goal is to increase enrollment in Jewish day schools because, he said, we fear we are losing large parts of the Jewish people. He said the initiative will focus on training teachers for Jewish education and Israel studies, as well as principals for Jewish day schools. Chikli did not elaborate on how his ministry would spend the allocation of 150 million shekels, nor did he detail when funds will make their way into North American Jewish schools. North American Jewish day schools have received varying levels of Israeli government support for some years, according to Paul Bernstein, the CEO of Prisma, a nonprofit that supports Jewish day schools. People are excited by the fact that the state of Israel really sees the importance of diaspora education and is recognizing that the strength of diaspora is integral to a strong Israel and strong relationships, said Bernstein. That's a very positive and important long-term development. The announcement came at a time of tension between Israel's right-wing governing coalition and North American Jewish communities, of course. Many U.S. Jewish leaders criticized the government's proposed overhaul of Israel's judiciary. Last month, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu canceled a speech at a signature conference of North American Jews in Tel Aviv because of anti-government protests. Chikli, who took his role in January, has defended the judicial overhaul while still acting as an ambassador of sorts to a skeptical audience of diaspora Jews. Chikli's father is a Jewish educator in Mexico. He had previously indicated that he sees Jewish day schools abroad as a critical destination for Israeli aid. He has said repeatedly that children who do not attend Jewish day schools are at risk of being lost to the Jewish people, adding, we're in the midst of a crisis where it's possible to lose an entire generation of Jews. Early in his tenure, Chikli floated the idea of working with philanthropists to subsidize day school tuition in the diaspora. More recently, he signaled that covering tuition, which can range from several thousand dollars at Haredi Orthodox yeshivas to more than $40,000 a year, is less of a priority. Jewish education in private schools is very expensive and at times out of range for the average family, Chikli said in April. This is where we step up to the plate. This isn't to say we're giving out free scholarships. We invest in the teachers, school systems to ensure Jewish education, the continuity of Jewish generations. We want to raise the pride of Jewish studies teachers. Attending a Jewish school is widely considered a strong predictor of lasting Jewish identity, although that may be because parents who prioritize Jewish identity are more likely to send their children to a Jewish day school, of course. Enrollment in Jewish schools in North America is growing, largely because of the growth of Orthodox communities, where the vast majority of children attend private Jewish schools. Outside of the Orthodox, most North American Jewish children do not go to Jewish day schools, of course. But the pandemic saw conservative reform and non-denominational day schools, often called community Jewish day schools, grow, according to a survey by Prisma that followed more than a decade of declines. Schools have maintained those enrollment gains, even as the pandemic ended. Meanwhile, Hebrew schools and other supplemental Jewish schools have shrunk by nearly half since 2006, according to a recent report by the Jewish Education Project. Chickley did not specify whether any of the new funding will go to supplemental Jewish schools. Chickley's father, Eitan Chickley, is the rector of the Hebraic University of Mexico City. Previously, he was the longtime director general of Israel's excellent Tali Education Fund, which promotes pluralistic Jewish education in Israeli schools and produces materials for use in Jewish schools abroad. And finally, fighting between Israel and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad terrorists in Gaza ended after 5 days, as a ceasefire took effect and held. Over the course of the fighting, 33 Palestinians were killed in Gaza, including some civilians and, of course, terrorists. 2 civilians were killed in Israel, a woman in the central Israeli city of Rehovot, and a Gaza resident working in a town on the Israeli side of the border. Islamic Jihad shot more than 1,000 rockets at Israel during the conflict. Many aimed at populated areas were intercepted by Israel's Iron Dome missile defense systems. Some fell short in Gaza itself. Israel conducted hundreds of airstrikes in Gaza. They killed 6 Islamic Jihad leaders. This round of fighting began after Israel killed those senior leaders. Those strikes followed a day of heavy conflict between the two sides a week before, after a senior member of Islamic Jihad died of a hunger strike in Israeli prison. The Israeli airstrikes came after far-right figures in Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu's governing coalition pushed for a harsher response to Gaza rockets. Egypt mediated the ceasefire between Israel and Islamic Jihad. A statement from Netanyahu's office thanked Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi and expressed the appreciation of the State of Israel for Egypt's intensive efforts to secure a ceasefire. The statement added that Israel would refrain from further airstrikes so long as rocket attacks from Gaza ceased. Unlike previous rounds of conflict between Israel and Palestinian terrorists in Gaza, Hamas, the terror group that controls the coastal strip and, like Islamic Jihad, is a designated terrorist organization by the U.S. and European Union, Hamas remained on the sidelines. Israel and Hamas have fought several times in recent decades. Their deadliest conflict took place in the 2014 Gaza War. And that's the news of Jews around the world. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Merrill Ain is the author of a new novel, Shadows We Carry, about twins. It's a fascinating continuation to some degree of her book, The Takeaway Men, an award-winning post-Holocaust debut novel published a few years ago. And we learned that she was originally a high school history teacher, has written nonfiction, 2 nonfiction books, appeared in many different publications, has a podcast, People of the Book. I have to quarrel with you. I know we're called the people of the book, but we really should be called the people of the books. Like
Yes.
I mean, Ecclesiastes says of the making of books, there is no end. And Ecclesiastes wrote that at least 2,300 years ago. And if he's writing about Jewish books, boy, is he right.
Well, I wish you had been around when I was trying to think of a name, because I felt, that was the only thing I could think of. And it, you know, it's been used so much. People of the books would have been a clever twist on it. So
it's not too late to change. We can always change. Judaism teaches this. Tell us kind of what it was like to write what is, I mean, I wouldn't say it's a sequel, but maybe you would. Tell us how you got into writing Shadows We Carry.
It is considered a sequel, but I believe it can be read as a standalone, because I think the story stands on its own. And I also give a list of characters, a brief description of the returning characters and the important new characters in the book for anybody who hasn't or, you know, prefers to read this book first. So there were a couple of reasons I wrote this, the sequel or the book. So the first reason is that I had a lot more to say on the topic. And my husband, who is my muse and my critic, and I showed him every chapter after I wrote it for the Takeaway Men. And when I showed him what became the last chapter, he said, okay, that's it. That's the end of the book. And I said, no, that's not the end of the book. The girls are only 15. I wanted to go, you know, into the 60s and the 70s. And he said, trust me, that's the end of the book. So I thought, and you know what? By then I was happy to be finished with the book.
Well, sure.
And I said, okay, if he thinks it's to the end of the book, I ended it there, basically with the revelation of a secret. And then what happened was, when the book was out in the world, almost immediately, I got a reaction. Believe it or not, some readers were annoyed at me, and they said, "Why you left us hanging? Why did you leave it there? Why did you stop there?" And others, you know, who really appreciated the book and had very nice things, they'd say, you must write a sequel. We're attached to these characters. We need to know what happens to them as they grow older. So those were really the two reasons. And the third was I really had a lot more to say on the topic.
So it's difficult to write sometimes without the character becoming some reflection of your own life. Do you find that to be true?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So I set the book originally, you know, with the first book, I had to make the decision of where the survivors were coming from. And I chose Kelce, Poland, because there had been a pogrom there a year after the war was over, which I found mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's horrifying.
But then I said, well, where am I going to, where are they going to live once they come here? And I took my cue from Philip Roth, who up until the time I joined the book club was really, I always read his novels and I loved his novels. And one of the reasons I loved them, besides loving his writing, was that he set most of them in northern New Jersey, particularly Newark. And that's where my father was born. I believe my grandfather, I never knew him, but I believe he was born there. And he was a musician by night, and he worked for the Metropolitan Life Company by day. And that's where a lot of Philip Roth characters worked. And they always say, write what you know. So I set it in my hometown. And in terms of, you know, I grew up during this time period. So there are things I remember. There are things I research. There's a strong thread of, you know, the fight for women's rights and discrimination against women. And I have, you know, one of my characters wants to be a journalist and she applies to journalism school, and they say, you know, they only take 20 women from the whole country, and she has to assure them that she's not going to get married and have a family. And that my husband went to graduate school for journalism, and one of his classmates, they had a reunion a couple of years ago, and she told me this story. So, you know, and I remember, you know, the assassinations and, you know, all that stuff. So, you know, it's based on the times in which I grew up.
What was the most challenging part about writing Shadows We Carry?
Well, let me go back to the takeaway men first, and I'm going to give you
sure.
two answers to that. The takeaway men, the most challenging thing was I had this story to tell. I've been obsessed with the Holocaust ever since I read the Diary of Anne Frank in the sixth grade. I you know, I was a history teacher. I've been researching it. I watch every film. I read every book. But I myself am not a child of Holocaust survivors. I do have many friends who are second generation, and we have known Holocaust survivors, and I have spoken to them. I have interviewed them. So I wanted to get their story right. And that's one of the reasons that I made Twins, because I created Twins because I didn't want to, you know, paint the children of Holocaust survivors with one brushstroke, even though they grew up with the same parents in the same home in the same environment. That cloud of the Holocaust was always over them, but they reacted in different ways. So that was the challenge, and that was also the challenge going forward. The other challenge was one of the main themes in Shadows We Carry is basically nature versus nurture, and are we our genes or are we our own people? And to that end, I have the son of a former Nazi, and I also have a Catholic priest who was given away by his Jewish parents,
right?
Right, during the Holocaust to a Catholic couple, and they perished, and he was raised Catholic, and he becomes a priest, and he...
And a very interesting character in your book, I have
yes,
to say.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I've always been interested in other religions, specifically Catholicism, but I did a lot of research, and I had sensitivity readers who were Catholic, because
sure.
I wanted to be sure that I portrayed him correctly.
The understanding of second and third generation survivors is not particularly deep in America. The way that those whose parents and even grandparents and even great-grandparents are impacted by that familial experience, it's very powerful and very meaningful. I think it's in some ways at the heart of this book, right?
It is the shadow
that they carry, right?
Shadow of the Holocaust.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you must know a fair number of people who are second and third generation survivors.
I know many, many, many. And I've consulted with them. They've told me their stories. I've interviewed them, and I have a large number of friends who are. So, yes.
Putting that on the page, how have they reacted to the book?
Good. Very good.
Okay.
Yes,
that's a very short answer.
No, they said you nailed it. You know, and certainly with the first one. And then with this one, I just had a call a few days ago from a former neighbor of mine who is a 2G. And she, you know, really loved the book. You got it right. And I've had a number of them tell me that. So I was, you know, concerned with the first book, but it's so far so good.
So far, that's always a good place to be. What was the biggest surprise in writing Shadows We Carry? Were there any?
I don't know that it's a surprise, but, you know, I've heard this and I just thought it was a cliche that the characters tell you where to go. Because in the first book, I don't know, I think, you know, it was my first novel and I think it was a little more of an effort for me. I just felt that they led me through this. And I wrote it during the pandemic. My husband had a kidney transplant about a year ago, and he was waiting for a kidney transplant, and we clearly weren't going anywhere. Yeah. So I wrote it in about 9 months, and it was pretty smooth process. They just took my hand and led me.
Well, they led you well.
Thank you.
A question about twins. Do you have twins in your life?
I do. I don't have twins, but my husband is an identical twin.
Oh, wow.
And the interesting thing is that I met my husband when I was on a blind date with his brother, and they switched. And what I learned...
That's the old joke, right?
You know? I know. But, well, okay,
it's a little rotten, let's be honest.
More about that. Uh-huh. And what I learned from them is, you know, they don't look exactly alike anymore, but they did. For instance, at our wedding, my brother-in-law walked down the aisle and people laughed and people gave him envelopes. But they have the same taste. They like the same foods. They went into the same profession. They like the same things, but their character and values are really very, very different. So, and they're identical. So I think, and I know, you know, with my own three children, they are all three different human beings. So I thought fraternal twins who are the same as siblings could be very different.
And they are, of course, often. Where can people go to find out more about you, about your work, and about Shadows We Carry?
Great. So the book is on Amazon. Both books are on Amazon. They can go to my website, MerylAine.com, and there's a lot more information about all my books and writing. My Facebook group is called Jews Love to Read. If you're on Facebook, please join us. We're almost at 4,000 members, and we have people from basically all over the world. Besides the United States and Canada, we have the UK, we have Australia, we have Israel, and it's a very eclectic group of people. You know, going from non-observant to Orthodox, they're men, they're women, they're rabbis, they're all kinds of people, avid readers in the book, and it's really a unique place to be. So hope join us there. And my podcast is People of the Book with Meryl Ain. It's on Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. But if you go to my Facebook page, MerylAine.com, it will take you to all these other places as well.
Thank you so much, Meryl. And best of luck with Shadows We Carry. It's a great read. And I look forward to doing this again after your next book.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
It's our pleasure. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
enterprise of the Pasquayaki tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Dr. Misha Galperin, a past guest of Too Jewish, president and CEO of the Weizmann National Museum of the American Jewish Experience as part of American Jewish Heritage Month. Please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha every Friday night for services and Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush. Live in person and available on our Facebook page. And come for Shavuot study after services this Friday night. Yisker services this coming Saturday morning. Our playout this morning is a very silly song about the Tikkun Leil Shavuot. It's called Stay Up All Night. This is the only parody I know of dedicated to the holiday of Shavuos. My friends, have a Chag Shavuot Sameach and a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week, we pray profoundly, of peace.
The 6th of Sivan, it's the day that we receive on.
Anything you want to learn, it's all right.
Put some water in the urn.
Stay up all night.
Put on your...
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.